This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. You just heard the opening movement, and now we're moving into the second movement of a work the New York Times has described as perhaps the most difficult string quartet composed. And for these brave performers, it is an immense accomplishment. But for the listener, it's a different experience. It was written by American composer Ben Johnston, my guest today. I was honored to have a chance to speak with Mr. Johnston. He turned 90 last March, and in April, the Kepler String Quartet on the New World Record label released the third and final volume in the first recorded complete cycle of my guest's 10 string quartets. They may be the greatest cycle of quartets composed thus far by an American composer, and yet so few still know my guest's work. John Rockwell once called him one of the best non-famous composers this country has to offer. He was born in Macon, Georgia, and was musically inclined and curious about sound from a young age. After bouncing through the Navy and various schools, he ended up at the Cincinnati Conservatory. He himself would end up teaching, based at the University of Illinois, from 1951 till 1986. Over the decades, he would be in contact with many of what were crowned the avant-garde composers in the U.S., from John Cage on down. But back to his younger years in Cincinnati, where he discovered a book by the composer-performer iconoclast Harry Partch, and he was interested in the work Partch was doing, for example, rejecting all standard and accepted Western music, instruments, and models, creating his own scales, tunings, and instruments to play his music. My guest was already working with microtones, those pitches that fall between the keys on your piano, so he went out to the West Coast and worked and mentored with Partch, and then began a half-century commitment to composing music using just intonation. Again, back to your piano, the distance between each key or pitch to your ears today is equal in space, due to equal temperament, which came into complete vogue and use in the 18th century and has dominated since. But before that, and still in many cultures around the globe, the ratio found between pitches to create scales, these originating and created from the overtone series as found in nature, is and was used and is known as just intonation. It was to this that my guest committed and on which he would compose. His greatest achievements are his 10-string quartets, and in fact, his best-known work is his Quartet No. 4, which incorporates the hymn Amazing Grace, a work played by many quartets, including, and most famously, the Kronos Quartet. When I first heard it, I was stopped in my tracks by its immense and complete fresh-sounding beauty. I still am to this day whenever I encounter the piece. But I'll leave that for you to discover, and you should, as it will not appear in this program. However, all the music you'll hear will be for string quartet, as we'll sample much from his other quartets outside of No. 4. I was honored to speak to Mr. Johnston a few weeks back, he at his home outside of Madison, Wisconsin. A very, well, philosophical conversation ensued. It was easier for him to use the speakerphone, so I'll ask your grace on the audio as we move forward. I am speaking today, very happy to be speaking today with composer Ben Johnston. I don't know if you're still celebrating, but I wanted to add my congrats on the fact that you turned 90 a couple months ago. You know, the composer ranks through the centuries have composers who were tragically lives left unfilled, meaning they didn't even make it to 40. We've got everything in between, but we also have a number of composers like you who've had a long career, decades of creativity. Are you still composing today?
Well, if I may stick in a word or two here, everybody is different, but everybody has certain similarities, and I think one of the similarities is a wish to be understood. And I felt very strongly that what I wanted to be understood about in music was not easy, either for me or for people who might really want to follow it. I can't take full credit for it, but I'm glad it turned out that I had to pull back from my original position more than once. And I think that the result has been more to my taste than I hope more to most people's taste. The events of the last year or two seem to bear that out. And the only difficulty I feel right now is that a lot of people understand more what is essentially a surface and not the depth. That's my fault, of course, because it's up to me as creative artist to project that. So much that I've done in the last few years results from that.
Are you still creating today, or do you still put pen to paper and compose in a way that you consider composition? Putting ideas down or?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure how to answer.
Oh, okay. But, Fair enough.
I think one of the problems I've encountered is that I've tried to make the music immediately accessible on one level, and then I've tried to say things that are anything but easy
right.
on another level.
Yep.
Because it seems to me that as an artist, what you say, what you are concerned with is one of the important things. And I wanted to be concerned with important things rather than just friendly things or enjoyable things or impressive things. You might want to use any one of those modes to do it, but that's not the basic aim. And very hard to establish that. I think I've been very fortunate in that the last few years have given me, I think, that kind of footing with at least a lot of people. I have tried to follow through on that. I think one of the dangers is that in making my music as accessible as I know how to make it, it would be easy to make the mistake of making it too accessible. Mm-hmm. And then its intention is misunderstood. So I've been very careful about that. And I feel that the success of recent releases of the quartets is the first time there's been a really strong response.
Yeah, there has been. The whole cycle that the Kepler has recorded is an amazing accomplishment. I just want to take our listeners back in your life, if I can, just a little bit. Even from a very early age, you seem to be fascinated with not only how music works, but how it sounded. And I'll touch on the Harry Partch experience, but I'm just wondering, even from that early age, did you have ideas of the compositional processes you would use, or did that come later after study with Millot, or even later in the 60s? I mean, where on that timeline did you start to think, I need to move in this direction with just intonation and microtonality, but I need to move in this path? Was it later, the 60s, or did you have ideas way before that, that you were going to move in a different direction?
Well, I've thought of one way to comment on your way of looking at it, and that is to call attention to the problem of stating things about religion and making sure that you're not either espousing a religion and using music do that, or criticizing it, using the music to do that. That means trying to get to the essence of what your religious convictions are. And I found that extremely useful in my life, not just in my career.
That's an interesting analogy.
I'm thinking that maybe one of the best things I've achieved for myself is a resolution on that level. And it amounts to not saying things in order to be believed, but saying them in order to provoke a view of whatever it is we're talking about.
So if I bring in the experience with Harry Partch, you read his book, you went out to work with him. It wasn't really a teacher-pupil relationship. You talk about, you know, stating your beliefs in music here. The work you did with him, which was not building the instruments, but tuning them and seeing how they worked, and seeing how he decided to do notation. I guess the question is, would you have developed the same path you took had you not had that experience with him? Or did that open different doors and gates in your mind of how you would go about doing what you just did, which is sort of stating what you believed in music?
Well, that's not easy to answer, but of course, any question that has depth will be that way. And I think my difficulty has been, as much as any other one, that I want to be immediately approachable, but at the same time, I don't want to be the sort of person who will do anything to be approached. I think that happens to a lot of artists. It's a trap. I don't think anybody wants to walk into a trap, but a lot of people do. And I wanted not to be one of those people if I could possibly avoid it.
I'm just thinking of how many composers have wanted to say exactly what you said, how you said it, but they haven't been able to put those words the way you did, because that's exactly how they feel. It's an interesting way to put that. From my guest Ben Johnston's String Quartet No. 2 from 1964, a work that is actually based on a tone row. In this second slow movement, the work moves from that row to his use of just intonation. It's performed by the Kepler Quartet. So when you decided, I'm going to work in just intonation, microtones, there were different paths. You could go on the Harry Partch path. You didn't. You tried out the electronic music path, but you decided to go with writing music for the most part for traditional instruments. I guess what the term the last couple generations is unplugged instruments, right? Acoustic instruments. I'm wondering for our listeners who are a little bit confused, I mean, it's clear in your head and it's very clear in the music, but about just intonation, if you could frame it for us, if you'll play along with me here, on a little historic basis. Just intonation actually had its roots in China, picked up in Europe in the late 16th century. But if we go before that, if we're, say, sitting in 1510 and we're playing a viol concert, does that get back to your method of how people listened to music, how people performed music back at a time before equal temperament?
Well, I think it's one of the most easily misunderstood intentions that I've had.
Okay.
And it can be misunderstood in various ways, but I think one of the most elusive for me to respond to is when people think, oh yes, this is the depth meaning. They come up with a metaphor for what they've heard. And that's not the point. The point is that what I'm trying to do is raise the question, raise it really. And in some cases, as with the tuning, I think I've succeeded. People don't know why this music has a certain kind of direct clarity, but they respond to it immediately. And it took me a long time to find out what would achieve. Is a symbol of an effort that we make, at least I hope we make, in our lives, be understood, not to be admired merely. The real set of alternatives is, have I really got something valuable to offer? If I have, has it been understood? And in doing that, I did not want to be simply a composer who wants to be the contemporary Beethoven. Temporary Bach or whatever, but someone who would like to be in that class, yes, who would, but at the same time has something quite his own to say, and it's not just anything that I say because I'm saying it is valuable, no, that's ego. It's that you learn something by being alive, and that this is a wish to let everybody benefit from it if possible, and then it means you have to work to some extent with a system of checks and balances. If you go too far in one direction, people may like it, but it's the wrong kind of like. In other words, it may make of you a kind of person who is not really trying to say what people think he is trying to say. I'm not sure how clear I'm making this, but...
No, I understand your point. If you go to the performer side, because they are the ones interpreting your music to an audience, at some point you had to cross the bridge, which Harry Partch had to do too. You did it differently. Of you're going to work with accomplished players on whatever instrument, string instrument, piano, voices, whatever, who are classically trained, and you had to notate your ideas, what you wanted to get across, what you're saying, and you had to find a system that would work. Even if it was difficult, even if it was hard or took time for the performers to grasp what they were supposed to do and what sound and what pitches and all the rest. Just curious on that decision of notation. It took a while, didn't it, to come up with something that was practical yet also informative to the performer, did it not?
Yes, and I'd say it took learning my direction. You know, I didn't know for a good long time what my direction really was. So it was a question of discovering that and not being carried away by some attractive and inviting way of looking at things. One of those would be using your talent to make money, having that as a basic aim. It's understandable, but not very admirable, it seems to me, at least from my point of view. And my point of view doesn't mean that if you are successful, that you're necessarily wrong. And that would be presuming that the only way to communicate with people is to lie. I don't believe that, but I think getting people really to a truth is the really important thing. And the way I hit it, it seems to me, hit at it, if you like, is to allow a variety of interpretations of your music and then to correct the ones as far as you're able are not what you really meant, and then also be willing to learn that what you really can change, legitimately change, in that it can get deeper and more useful. But it seems to me that my aim has been, in the long run, to be as useful to people, but also demanding of them, but not demanding in a way that will make them say, oh, it's too much, I don't like that.
That holds true even on the performer side, too. I mean, you must have...
Yes, well, it applies to the communication as a whole, you know, performers along with.
Right.
So that if you don't work with performers or aren't able to work with them or don't want to or they don't want you to for whatever reasons, that's a big gap to be filled in, and not just with refuse.
Here once again is the Kepler Quartet. This time we'll hear some of the final minutes from my guest's String Quartet No. 5. As noted in the introduction, with his popular String Quartet No. 4 incorporating Amazing Grace, this Quartet No. 5 from 1979 seems to use in an altered form the folk song Lonesome Valley, music by my guest today, Ben Johnston. Thank you. Thinking of performers, I guess, more performers than composers here in this question, but the methods you've used and the tunings you've used over the decades, there have been some colleagues of yours, some students of yours who have picked this up and sort of gone down the same path, gone down with the same methods, but there've been few. There haven't been a lot. However, the last decades, much more than when you were younger, has seen an explosion of music from different cultures around the world who have expanded scales. They have microtonality. They have different tunings. And so you have a lot of performers now who this is not all that odd to them. It's not strange to them. Have you seen that that's beneficial, not only to your music, but to the ideas and the methods you've used, that it's kind of more prevalent now, these different sounds that come to our Western ears?
Thank you. It's very interesting to have you say that, because it reflects very much an attitude that I have developed. It came from wanting to work with people who had an equal commitment to mine. I don't mean the same one necessarily. Better when it tests you by pulling you in directions that you might otherwise not have thought of.
Right.
And also making you be clearer. You know, you have to be able to say, oh, that sounds nice, but it's not at all what I thought when I wrote it. And then to be willing to listen to a reaction like, well, we think that your achievement is not the one you aimed at, but better. Now then there's a question, well, show me what you think about that. Show me, not just tell me. And I feel that it has been a matter of getting closer to the performance, but not in the sense of friendship. Yes, you do cultivate friendship that way, and it's quite meaningful, but I would say it's not the only aim. It's a mean, and it's a reward, if you like, that comes from making an effort that is mutual and yet compensatory. That is, you know, if I find, for example, that I have performance nerves, which I do, then I have to allow for that and not take on a performing job, which isn't going to succeed because of that fear. Then what do I do instead? And I'd say my solution has been to make a much closer relationship with the performer on an artistic level. That is, what you decide to spend your talent on, and what you decide to learn that you didn't already know. I must say I didn't start out with all the aims that I had during the last year or so. And I feel that what I've reached in that amount of time is due to working so closely with other musicians, not just performers, but other arrangers and composers. And I find that trying to help in what they're trying to do has been at least as useful to me as a human being as composer.
Has that scenario, that situation you just described a couple minutes ago, where the performer, the interpreter of your music, turns to you and says, you know, I know this is not what you have on the page, but it works better. This has that happened to you, where the suggestion comes from the performer to you, and you say, ah, I understand, and you're right? Has that happened?
Yes, it has. And it's happened both ways. It's happened when I've been able to help another person to see that in his work or her work.
Okay.
And to say, if I were doing it, I might do it this way, but that's me. Find your way of approaching this. Huh. And it's as if, you know, you were saying to people, well, I like you. And then people shrink back because it somehow isn't clarified to the point where, what do you mean by like? What is it that you like, and what do you don't like? I'm not sure that's a very good comparison. But
From the three-disc set of the 10-string quartets by my guest today, Ben Johnston, here is the Kepler Quartet performing the first movement from his 1988 Quartet No. 9. I mentioned before the different paths you could have chose. I talked about the electronic music one, and you tried doing that. The electronic music was still in its, I don't want to say infancy, but it wasn't up to the task of what you wanted it to do. But just as I said about the explosion of performers from different cultures, where different tunings, different scales are commonplace, also what's happened in the last decades, and I'm saying this, Ben, so I can show that you've sort of been ahead of the curve, is that, you know, digital music, electronic music, and technology has just gone so fast. There's been such an advancement in this that things you wanted to do decades ago are now easy to do and commonplace. Have you sort of kept up with the trends and technology in regards to your compositional process?
Well, let me add something to that and comment on it that way. What I will add is that question arose when I began to ask myself, what is your religious connection to this? And by that, I don't mean something that you belong to in the sense of becoming a Catholic or becoming Protestant of any one of various denominations. It means you are organizing your life around this. If it's really a religion, then what are you organizing your life around? And are you sure you want to do that? And does it cover everything that's And sometimes the answer is not yet. Sometimes the answer is no, it doesn't. Why not? And I remember that I reached a point where I thought my music is beginning to have an effect on other people. I don't want that to be, from a meaning of life angle, a trivial effect. And how do I make sure? Well, I don't know that you make sure except by pondering. You need the meaningful.
So I'm trying to tie what you just said into advancements in technology, which actually have made some of the processes you've used in your music easier.
Well, I mean, if you are really saying something important, it will have things in common and will have divergences from other people's similar efforts. You begin to compare yourself to that and say, yes, I agree with this person up to a point. Then we differ. And in looking at the difference, say, what does that mean? Well, for one thing, it means we're two different people. If you're coming from the east and going west, you don't want to go south instead or north. It's not your intention. Well, then there's a question of what is your intention, the real one? Is it a good one? And what does good mean? So I'm getting at questions like that. One of the questions I was asking myself was, if this is not useful, I would like it to be. It's a work of art. You should be able to make use of it.
I think what's fascinating, too, is there's a New York Times article a couple months ago about your quartet series and the Kepler and the recordings and the performance. And it cited that your seventh string quartet is been given the moniker, I don't know if you roll your eyes at this or not, as the most difficult ever written. And to someone reading that who said, well, I'd like to hear this piece, that's very foreboding. But I think that the paradigm is switched. It's very difficult for the Kepler performers, the artists in the Kepler quartet, to learn this piece. It takes them a long time to learn the piece. But for the listener, I know you've talked about this over the course of this time we've chatted, but for the listener, it's like kind of switched. The difficulty is not the same as the difficulty for the performer. And I don't know if I'm being clear on that, but it's an interesting change of paradigm that your music communicates much more directly, perhaps with an audience, be it dissonant or not, in a different way than the difficulty that it has for the performer. And I find that interesting. I don't know if you agree with that, but I find it very interesting. Because that's not always the case, and it has not always been the case over the decades of new music from the late 20th century.
Well, I've always wanted to do something that would be useful, and I mean genuinely useful, useful in the deepest sense. And that's quite a thing to ask of yourself. So my, so to speak, prayer, if I'm wrong, show me if I'm not wrong, show me that too. But don't let me get carried away by it. Carried away by that, I'm lost in. I was so concerned with a particular way of writing a phrase that you always do it. It's your signature. It's as if that is who I am. It's the accusation that was made by, I think, Rimsky-Korsakov of Salieri in the Mozart and Salieri. What was the difference? So many superficial similarities, but an almost indefinable difference that fits into that Mozart didn't ever let you predict what he was going to do. He always managed to do something that you had to really think about and have it seem as simple as it does.
This is music not by my guest, but by George Gershwin, but in a version for string quartet by my guest today, Ben Johnston, of course using just intonation, a setting of Gershwin's How Long Has This Been Going On from a set of altered classics my guest titled Revised Standards, performed here by the Eclipse String Quartet. Last thing, but it takes you to a different part of your career, and that's teaching. It's a personal thing. I graduated from Northwestern University in 1981 on the books, studying composition, graduate level. And the year I left, it was rumored that you were coming to Northwestern to teach. So people like me who were graduating were very sad about that because we wouldn't have the chance to study with you. But the people behind me were excited. But that didn't happen. You didn't go to Northwestern. You were in Illinois for all those years, and I'm just wondering whether your time, because you were in Illinois, and I'm a Chicago boy, so I know that university, I know where you were in the state, and you weren't in New York, you weren't in the center of all that. Do you look back and see that that shaped you or was beneficial? Did it really leave a stamp that the fact that you were not in the center of activity and buzz, such as a New York City, or did it not have any outcome on your output in your career?
Well, I think sometimes that what you need is what you're trying to avoid. And I think you've got to include in your intentions that that be allowed for. In other words, you're asking for a comment from somebody. What do you think of this? What do you want when they say, well, it sounds like late Beethoven, but it isn't, and here's why. And the question then would be, what is it about late Beethoven that makes it so special? It is that he couldn't even hear it. He had to be sure without actually being able to give it the acid test. When I heard it, did I like it? Or did it suit what I wanted to say? There was a point in my studying with Darius Milhaud when he said that we should choose a topic. Now, I was one of the last people to choose, because I was not in the class at the beginning of it. And I wanted to choose a composer who had written refused to let anybody know how he did what he did. That could have included Mozart. It could have included Debussy. It could have included a lot of people. The question then would be, why particular one? And I asked this Bartok because I thought that East-West mixture was extremely challenging, and his refusal to say what determined his compositional decisions. They didn't want to do that because the group that was playing the Bartok Quartet was not going to be in residence and couldn't be consulted very easily. So what I did was to choose late Beethoven instead. So I knew those works in some depth, and I can see why they're not easy to play. Not so much the technique, it's the thinking. I like that quality in my own work. I'm not sure how often I get there, if I ever do.
Oh, you have. I think those who have known your music for many decades, or those, as you said at the top of this talk, who are discovering it in the last years, I think that comes through very clearly. Well, I didn't get to study with you 35 years ago, but I really enjoyed talking with you and for you taking some time. Thank you so much.
Well, I don't know quite how to respond.
You don't have to respond. That's okay. I'm glad I got a chance to talk with you. Composer Ben Johnston, the three separate discs which make up the complete recordings of his 10 string quartets as performed by the Kepler Quartet, Sharon Leventhal and Eric Segnitz violins, Breck Renzelman viola, and Carl Levine cello, are on the New World Record label and can be found at newworldrecords.org. And as I stated at the top, if you don't know his music and this program has piqued your interest, I highly, highly recommend listening to a recording of his most popular work, the String Quartet No. 4, Amazing Grace, which, as the composer wanted, is to be paired with the String Quartet No. 3, and is so on the Kepler recording. I will, however, leave you with the final movement from his last quartet, the Quartet No. 10 from 1995, and as you'll listen, you'll hear another well-known and beloved tune making its appearance in this final movement, as performed by the Kepler Quartet, music by my guest today, Ben Johnston, and as always, I'm glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, in an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.